Well, as you know, brethren and sisters, there's a change to the printed programme. And this evening we have an address to be given by Brother Joel Toms in the series The Minor Prophets. He's going to speak to us on the prophecy of Micah. And so now I have pleasure in asking him to speak to us on that subject. Joel.
Well, good evening, my dear brethren and sisters. So tonight we are to consider the prophecy of Micah. To start with then, the name Micah is a variant of Micaiah, or in Hebrew, Micaiahu, which means who is like Yah, or who is like God. And so straight away, the name of the prophet is in itself a reverential term. The book itself is set apart from most of the other prophecies that we have by the very first words reported by the prophet, Micah 1 verse 2. And it might be worth having Micah open in front of us. We haven't had a reading. We'll be looking through the book in a little more detail. So it'd be good to have that in front of us. Micah 1 verse 2. Hear, you peoples, all of you. Listen, earth, and all who live in it. Immediately then, the book is addressed to all nations, to the earth and all who live in it. It's very unusual, possibly unique, to have such a broad term of address. We know some of the other prophecies are about other nations. For example, the prophecy through Obadiah is about the nation of Edom. The prophecy through Amos is about a variety of Israel's neighbours. But it's very uncommon to hear an address to all of humanity, as we have at the beginning of Micah. So, this evening, first of all, we'll consider a little bit of the background to the book, when it was written, when Micah lived and worked. We'll have a look at an overview of the book, and that will take up most of our time, and then after that we'll summarise and see what conclusions we can draw. So first of all, something of the background to the book of Micah. Micah 1 verse 1 is the first clue. The word of the Lord that came to Micah of Moresheth during the reigns of Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah. The vision he saw concerning Samaria and Jerusalem. So here we read that the prophet Micah was born in the tiny village of Moresheth in the foothills of Judah, about 15 or 20 miles to the west of Jerusalem. And these three kings that I mentioned, they place Micah in the middle of the 8th century BC. For some historical context, in 722 BC, the Assyrians destroyed Samaria in partial fulfillment of some of Micah's prophecy. And in 701 BC, the Assyrians besieged Jerusalem. And as we know, that siege did not succeed, but it was certainly still a traumatic event. That's recorded in the 2nd of Kings, chapters 18 and 19. Micah himself almost certainly lived through these events which he prophesied. So Micah was sent to the nation of Judah, up to the reign of Hezekiah, that great king who reformed the nation. And so we know from this that Micah's work was ultimately effective, at least to some extent. And this is also mentioned in the prophet, in the book of Jeremiah, Jeremiah 26, verses 18 and 19, where we read, Micah of Moresheth prophesied in the days of Hezekiah, king of Judah. He told all the people of Judah, this is what the Lord Almighty says, Zion will be ploughed like a field, Jerusalem will become a heap of rubble, the temple hill a mound overgrown with thickets. Did Hezekiah, or king of Judah, or anyone else in Judah, put him to death? Did not Hezekiah fear the Lord and seek his favour? And did not the Lord relent so that he did not bring the disaster he pronounced against them? So from this reference in Jeremiah, at least, we can see that the work of Micah did have some success in his own time. Contemporaries of Micah include Isaiah, who was prophesying also to Judah, and then the prophets Amos and Hosea, who did their work in the northern kingdom of Israel. So, the world of Micah, the world in which he grew up. Before Micah was born, Israel had King Jeroboam II and Judah King Uzziah. During this time, and for a few decades, certainly either side, Judah and Israel enjoyed peace and resulting prosperity. Israel being, as we know, in a very strategic location between the desert and the sea on a very important trade route between the great civilizations of Africa, which would be Egypt, Ethiopia, Libya, and so on, and those in Mesopotamia, the rising powers of Assyria and Babylon. And this prosperity certainly was a blessing, but also came as a temptation. In a couple of places, we read about how the law of Moses has some provisions to protect against the excesses of materialism and the resulting trap of poverty, which results for the majority of the population. We might think, for example, of the Sabbath years, the year of Jubilee, to cancel debts, forbidding issuing crippling interest or securities, certain requirements for giving charity, and so on. We'll read a couple of those. Firstly, from Exodus 23 and verse 10, where we read, "For 6 years you are to sow your fields and harvest the crops, but during the seventh year let the land lie unploughed and unused. Then the poor among your people may get food from it, and the wild animals may eat what is left. Do the same with your vineyard and your olive grove." So that is, of course, establishing the Sabbath years for the benefit of the poor of the land. Later on in Leviticus chapter 25, the whole chapter, in fact, is devoted to the subject. In verse 10, we read, "Consecrate the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout the land to all its inhabitants. It shall be a jubilee for you. Each of you is to return to your family property and to your own clan." And there, of course, detailing the year of jubilee, which has happened every 50 years. And the spirit of these provisions is summed up in verse 46 of that chapter, Leviticus 25, where it simply states, "You must not rule over your fellow Israelites ruthlessly." Unfortunately, in the time of Micah, the material wealth and the prosperity of the time led to a mercantile attitude. People ignored these commands in pursuit of wealth. We will look later on in a little more detail. But the problem is explained in verse 9 of Micah chapter 1. "For Samaria's plague is incurable. It has spread to Judah. It has reached the very gate of my people, even to Jerusalem itself." And some more details at the beginning of chapter 2. "Woe to those who plan iniquity." And later on, "They covet fields and seize them, and houses and take them. They defraud people of their homes. They rob them of their inheritance." And this environment of materialism, individualism, greed is the subject of much of Micah's immediate focus. And Micah himself, as a man from a small country village, almost certainly hailed from the oppressed underclass, the majority who were suffering from the suffering in effect from the prosperity of the nation. And this oppression and indifference from the ruling classes forms the background to Micah's prophecy. So that's the world in which Micah lived and grew up and in which he preached to the people. I will now take an overview of the book, chapter by chapter, and in so doing we'll hopefully establish the message or the messages which Micah sought to convey. As we read the book of Micah, there are two distinct themes. The first we've already mentioned. The first theme is of the immediate evils present in the land. And Micah's focus is particularly on social injustice rather than any religious deficiencies, which is usually the subject of prophecies, to do with idol worship and so on. Micah rather focuses on the material excesses of the people, and therefore on the retribution which was to be meted out in due course. This took the form of the fall of Samaria to the Assyrians in Micah's time, and later on, of course, the fall of Jerusalem to the Babylonians also. But the other theme to be found in the book of Micah, and this is of particular relevance to us, and the reason for the broadest possible audience for the book, which we mentioned at the beginning, the second theme is of the glorious future of God's people, and accompanying that, a vision of the Messiah. So, in chapter 1, after we are introduced to the prophet, we immediately encounter an awesome vision of an avenging God. Micah 1, verse 3. Look, the Lord is coming from his dwelling place. He comes down and treads on the heights of the earth. The mountains melt beneath him, and the valleys split apart like wax before the fire, like water rushing down a slope. And then we are presented with two cities, the capitals of their respective nations, Samaria and Jerusalem. Now, these cities, as capitals, were, of course, the centres of wealth and power in their countries. But they're also the focus of Micah's prophecy, and I think this emphasises how ingrained and how central, how mainstream these sinful attitudes had become. And it's particularly powerful to refer to Jerusalem, home of God's temple, his dwelling place on earth, as an idolatrous high place, and that's in verse 5 of this chapter 1. But the idolatry Micah was focusing on, of course, is not religious, but material. And later on in verse 9, as we mentioned, it seems that, first of all, Israel succumbed to this evil, to this temptation, and then Judah was later swayed by her neighbour. One other little point from chapter 1, the towns which are listed in the second half of the chapter. These were almost certainly subject to the Assyrian conquest later on, because we remember though the Assyrians failed to capture Jerusalem, they did march through many Judean cities before they reached Jerusalem. These towns rather are surrounding the prophet's hometown of Moresheth. So it's an interesting focus on the prophet here rather than on the nation as a whole. And each of these towns has a separate little comment. Some of these are little plays on words. For example, the town name Moresheth Gath sounds like the Hebrew word for fiancé. And so the comment offered for that town is that it's been offered parting gifts, perhaps parting gifts as if to join a new family, like a fiancé. Later on, Marishah sounds like the Hebrew word for conqueror. And the comment there is, I will bring a conqueror against you who live in Marishah. So it's a little insight, something we miss in English, but an insight into the, the literary quality of the book of Micah as well as its spiritual message. But in any case, these towns and others were clearly not to be spared the impending havoc representing God's judgment. And it's in chapter 2 that we start to see the problem explained. Chapter 1, we read about God's wrath and the punishment for the nation's sin. In chapter 2 and 3, we start to see the details of the evils committed by Israel and Judah. Firstly, Micah 2, verse 6. Do not prophesy, their prophets say. Do not prophesy about these things. Disgrace will not overtake us. So we see here, again, a recurring problem for these two nations, that of false prophets. And later in this chapter, there is a detail of the sins which the people were committing. Verses 8 and 9. Lately, my people have risen up like an enemy. You strip off the rich robe from those who pass by without a care, like men returning from battle. You drive the women of my people from their pleasant homes. You take away my blessing from their children forever. And this, and continuing, is a description of the unlawful exploitation of God's people by some of those very people. And of course, these two problems go together. The false prophets only make the other evils worse because they serve to convince the people to continue in their evil ways. And in verse 11, we get a sense it's not just God who's fed up with this. Verse 11 in chapter 2. If a liar and deceiver comes and says, I will prophesy for you plenty of wine and beer, that would be just the prophet for this people. And it's hard to imagine that Micah himself had no input in forming those words. So Micah pithily makes the point that the people are happy to listen when it suits them to do so. But immediately after this, and this is a feature of this book, the end of chapter 2 is one of Micah's visions of the future, so the second theme we mentioned. Verses 12 and 13, I will surely gather all of you, Jacob. I will surely bring together the remnant of Israel. I will bring them together like sheep in a sheepfold, like a flock in its pasture. The place will throng with people. The one who breaks open the way will go up before them. They will break through the gate and go out. Their king will pass through before them, the Lord at their head. And it's an interesting juxtaposition of these two ideas. Chapter 2, verse 11, is almost a joke. It's so scathing of Israel's attitude. Well, it clearly expresses a deep and severe anger on God's behalf. That verse 11 is an expression of the things an expression of the things that Israel wanted to hear, whereas verses 12 and 13 are an expression of the things that God wanted them to hear. Those things it should have been yearning for. A time when the nation would be redeemed to God and would return to his care under their king, in verse 13. It's as if the prophet can't help but be emotionally involved. Much as God himself does, Micah wants the people to return to the proper faith. And perhaps this break in the narrative, this vision of the future, of hope, perhaps this was intended for those of Micah's hearers who were, like him, from the underprivileged and exploited lower class, and who had little choice but to look forward to a glorious future, unlike their wealthy counterparts who had, in the words of Jesus, received their reward in full. But after this brief interlude at the end of chapter 2, chapter 3 is particularly vivid as an exposé of Israel and Judah's sinful practices, and particularly the first three verses of chapter 3. Then I said, listen, you leaders of Jacob, you rulers of Israel. Should you not embrace justice, you who hate good and love evil, who tear the skin from my people and the flesh from their bones, who eat my people's flesh, strip off their skin and break their bones in pieces, who chop them up like meat for the pan, like flesh for the pot. Now we hope this is not meant literally. But even if it's not, it does graphically illustrate the severity of the situation in God's eyes. I think in our society we are perhaps more accustomed to the materialism, the accumulation of wealth, at a dubious human cost. This characterizes our whole civilization. But this was not to be the way for God's people. It was against the law of Moses, and therefore it led to needless suffering and misery. The rest of the chapter continues by detailing the work of the false prophets and the corruption that was prevalent in the ruling classes, and ends with those words quoted in Jeremiah, verse 12. Therefore, because of you, Zion will be ploughed like a field. Jerusalem will become a heap of rubble, the temple hill a mound overgrown with thickets. And the power of these words is demonstrated by the fact they survived until Jeremiah's time. But after this, once again, in chapter 4, we have another vision of a glorious future, set directly against this doom and gloom for the present. There's a glorious vision of Israel's future. And even in English, the poetry in this chapter is sublime. I would like to be able to read it all. Unfortunately, I don't think we have the time. And in this chapter, there are a great many verses we recognise easily. The first verse, following the immediate future when Zion was to be destroyed, describes a time when it will again become the centre of worship for God's people. And not just Jews, but people from every nation. Micah 4 verse 1, in the last days, the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as the highest of the mountains. It will be exalted above the hills, and peoples will stream to it. And this again is why the beginning of the book invites you peoples, all of you, and the earth and all who live in it, to heed its message. Because this glorious future, of course, does indeed concern God's family from every nation. Now, verses 2 to 5 are very well known. I'm sure we can read those in our own time. I would like to read them now, but I won't do that because you all have them in front of you. From verse 6, it starts to become a little hard to distinguish the visions of this glorious ultimate future from the visions of the immediate catastrophe. Except, of course, with hindsight, we recognise various features of each. And the prophet's use of the word now in chapter 4, verses 9 and verse 11 is not actually particularly helpful. It does indicate that we're referring to a particular time in the narrative, but almost certainly not the present day as it was then. Verse 10, for example, says, "You will go to Babylon, there you will be rescued." And that's clearly referring to a more immediate judgment, the captivity in Babylon, although a century or so in the future, but still a punishment for the sins of the time. Whereas verse 11 and 13, "But now many nations are gathered against you. Rise, daughter of Zion, and you will break to pieces many nations." That verse clearly refers to the end times. So sometimes when reading this book, it can be hard to establish a chronology. But with knowledge of God's plan for the end times and also our knowledge of the history of the nation, it should be possible to distinguish the two from each other. But in the whole chapter, Micah is describing the mechanism by which God's people will be saved, whether immediately or at the end of days. And then ultimately he is describing the glorious future which awaits. So we come to chapter 5, where we have a brief vision of the promised king. And again, in verse 1, we have the use of the word now, which doesn't tell us a great deal. I think in this example, we can assume it refers to the siege of Samaria, so it seems we've skipped a few years ahead. And verse 2 then says, "But you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, though you are small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will be ruler over Israel, whose origins are from of old, from ancient times." So, in the context of the siege of Samaria, a terrible event in the present day, as it was, a Messiah is promised. Again, of course, part of God's ultimate plan for the salvation of his people. Just one quick point then about the phrase, the origins being from of old. Sometimes people use this to demonstrate the pre-existence of Christ before his birth. I think there's no justification for that. In fact, it comes out better in this version than it does in some other versions. The origins being from of old simply refers either to the patriarchs, the nation of Israel being established centuries prior to the days of Micah, or it refers in broader sense to God's plan having been established, as we know, from creation itself. Again, in this chapter, it's difficult to distinguish the futures described. But eventually, God will destroy all those things which wicked Israel thought they could rely upon in his place. Verses 10 to 15 of that chapter 5 list some of those things. In that day, declares the Lord, I will destroy your horses, your chariots, the cities of your land, your strongholds, your witchcraft and spells, idols, sacred stones. I will uproot your Asherah poles. I will take vengeance in anger and wrath on the nations that have not obeyed me. And the ultimate aim of this, of course, is that God's people should look away from their material possessions and their material creations and the imaginations of the false religions, and they should look to God and to his appointed heir, their Messiah, who's mentioned at the beginning of the chapter. But in chapter 6, just in case the listeners were becoming complacent in this image of salvation, the vision of their Messiah to come, the message returns from this vision of the future to the present day and to the evils for which God was accosting the people. And so we hear once again about the dishonesty, about the sinful manipulative practices of those who through greed were failing to uphold the law and to care for their fellow Jews. Now in chapter 7, at the end of the book, we'd expect something of an epilogue. The beginning of the chapter almost reads like a vision of a dystopian future. Perhaps after the nation has been destroyed by the invading armies. But in fact, we read in verse 3 of those same sins that we encountered earlier in the book and which Micah was prophesying against. And we realise that Micah is still talking about the present day. The desolation which he talks about is simply perhaps not even a metaphor, perhaps it's a literal consequence of Israel's sinful practices. And the tone of this chapter reveals, not for the first time, the emotional involvement of Micah in his ministry. He says, and we can assume this is the prophet speaking, in verse 1, what misery is mine? But despite this, once again, and for the last time in this prophecy, the narrative rises from the gloom and the horror of the present to look forward once again to the ultimate fulfillment of God's plan of salvation for his faithful. And this looking up towards the end begins in verse 7, where Micah asserts his own faith. But as for me, I watch in hope for the Lord. I wait for God my Saviour. My God will hear me. And for chapter 7, verse 14, we start to read how God will lead his people. This positivity, I'm sure, is possible because of Micah's absolute trust in God's enduring faithfulness. The prophecy concludes in verse 20, you will be faithful to Jacob and show love to Abraham as you pledged on oath to our ancestors in days long ago. So, to summarise, the book of Micah invites all nations to hear. It deals first of all with the sins of material greed and selfishness that plagued God's people, and therefore the punishment that was necessarily to be meted out as a result. However, set against this is the constant reminder of God's ultimate plan to redeem all of his faithful and to establish his people at the centre of his love and care. So what do we conclude from a study of Micah? Certainly we can learn from the commentary upon materialism and selfish attitudes as things to be avoided, and instead replaced with a generous charity. It's a little different for us in the present day, because we are not a nation in the conventional sense. We do not exist as an economic entity. I mean, certainly we have charitable status, we have bank accounts for certain purposes and so on. But we are involved in the wider world by necessity. At the very least, though, the book of Micah clearly exhorts the faithful to have careful regard for other members of God's family, and therefore to ensure that by our actions, or indeed by inaction, we do not place any of that family in need. This message then is rather similar to that carried all the way through to the letter of James, James 1 verse 27. Religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this: to look after orphans and widows in their distress, and to keep oneself from being polluted by the world. And an almost identical sentiment. In fact, you could say it summarizes the wonderfully simple, although certainly not easy to follow, instruction of the gospel, is expressed in the book of Micah itself, in chapter 6, which we didn't quote from. But I'll end with these words, because I think they summarise nicely what the book is trying to say. And that's Micah 6, verse 8, very well-known words. He has shown you, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you? But to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God.